Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has considerable intelligence and who is bringing it to bear, thank God, on behalf of the readiness of our military and more broadly our national security is our first guest. He is Congressman Rob Wittman. He represents with great distinction the people of the 1st District of Virginia. He is a member of the House Armed Services Committee and chairs its Readiness Subcommittee. Also serves in a number of other capacities, including as co-chair of the Congressional Shipbuilding Caucus and the chairman of the Republican Study Committee's Military Readiness Task Force. Congressman Wittman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to talk with you, sir.
Frank, it's fantastic to be back with you this morning.
Well, I'm sorry to say that the news isn't good, it would seem, on the portfolio you have responsibility for in the Armed Services Committee. Give us a sort of overview, if you would, Congressman. You're kind enough to visit with us from time to time to do this, but the state of affairs, as you see it, with respect to the readiness of America's military these days.
Absolutely, Frank. Our readiness within every branch of our military is well behind where it needs to be just to meet the national security strategy, and that concerns me. And whether it's lacking the number of ships necessary to carry out those missions, whether it's lacking the equipment that's properly maintained so it's ready to go when it's called upon, whether it's soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen that are lacking the training necessary, whether it's lacking the number of Air Force maintainers for the aircraft that we have, whether it's ships not getting to the yard to be repaired so that they're ready to go to sea. I could go down the list, and it is long and it is alarming as to where the current state of our military affairs rests. And, Frank, the key with this is that it will take years for us to restore that full-spectrum readiness. That should concern all of us, and it is purely a function of the efforts in the past 3 to 4 years with the sequester and the continued effort, too, and by the executive branch to say, well, we're going to pare things down. We're going to reduce the end strength of the Army. We're not going to be putting fighter jets on the decks of aircraft carriers. Those types of critical decisions lead to where we are today. Congress has been, unfortunately, a part of this in years past by not putting the proper amount of resources there through this ridiculous practice called the sequester, one that I objected to as it was laid out in relation to what was going to happen, the expenditures there. And we find ourselves in that same situation today, now trying to play catch up. And it's not merely a matter of resources today, Frank. It's a matter of capacity to rebuild that. We could throw all the money in the world at it, but there's only so much capacity to rebuild that readiness. That's one of the challenges I think we have today.
It is indeed. And as you know so well, Congressman Rob Wittman, even if you had all of the money and even if you had the capacity, there's a certain irreducible amount of lead time that it's going to take to rehabilitate these forces. And I'd like to ask you, if you could quickly, to just talk about, in addition to sequestration, Congressman, the cumulative impacts of the fixed costs of operating our military these days, which continue to rise inexorably. And I'm thinking about health care and I'm thinking about other benefits and so on. But they're taking a bigger and bigger bite, as you know, of the apple. And I just wonder, as you look at readiness, does the fact that the administration is insisting on putting more women into ground combat positions and the like not give rise inevitably to problems for those units as those women become hurt, as they will, as they become pregnant, as some of them will, and otherwise become unavailable to their units?
Well, Frank, as you look at how women are integrated into these combat military occupation specialties, better known as MOSs, the thing that we can't lose focus on is that we must assure that the requirements for individuals that operate within those combat units, those combat MOSs, cannot change. And if a woman can function within that realm, if they can meet the same physical requirements, if they can meet the same tactical requirements, then by all means, they ought to be part of that. But it is an extraordinarily rigorous process that individuals go through now, men or women, to do that. And we should never, never as a force, move away from those requirements. And I think if you do that and you require the same of men and women in those categories, then it can be done successfully. Now, there are logistical elements there that have to happen as you integrate women into those units. There is a culture in those units. There are things that create somewhat of a challenge in the field. Those things remain to be seen as to how the policies are put in place to deal with that. But I know the one thing that is for certain is that the requirements in those positions cannot change. And we cannot allow a situation to say, well, there aren't enough women in those units, therefore we're going to change those standards in order to meet a certain number of women. That's the point that I think becomes very problematic and becomes dangerous for those units and for the women that could serve there if we change the standards or if we go to some kind of quota system and say, well, you have to have a certain number of women there.
Let me talk about this in not the abstract so much, but in a very concrete context with you, Congressman Rob Whitman. You recently returned from a tour of our units in the Pacific, and you were assessing their readiness. And I know you've just spoken to some of the findings there, but it's happening against the backdrop, the hollowing out of our military, I don't know what else to call it, at a moment when China particularly is becoming more and more aggressive. You've talked about a pattern of incitement. I think it applies to the Russians as well as the Chinese. But just staying with China, what is you see coming if we're not careful here? Is it likely that we could come to blows as a result of what China's up to?
Well, Frank, that becomes a growing possibility as we see China continue very aggressive efforts and operations in that area of the world, and specifically in the South China Sea. As I went and visited with our allies in Japan, they are deeply concerned about that. I also visited with our military leaders and allies in South Korea. They were extraordinarily concerned about the efforts by the Chinese in the South China Sea to reclaim islands there, over 3,000 acres now. And reclaiming that land on islands is for one single purpose, for a strategic purpose, and we already see them building airstrips there, them hardening those facilities, putting additional anti-aircraft batteries into places like Woody Island in the Paracels. All of those efforts, Frank, we believe, are to, first of all, create an area where they will limit, if not stop, any kind of operations of military ships and military aircraft. The only reason you put anti-aircraft batteries in there is to impede the operation of military aircraft in that area. And also, the reason that you harden those islands is to put military facilities there. And as you know, we have been very aggressive in putting these freedom of navigation operations in there to make sure that we push the limit as far as saying you cannot limit navigational operations of military ships inside of 12 miles outside of 12 miles of those islands there. So those are the things that we are doing. We were impressing upon the naval leaders there to make sure that they do on an unannounced basis those freedom of navigation operations there. And we do everything we can to stem the increase of activity in those areas. In other words, to dissuade the Chinese from doing that. My concern is that, you know, once they do that in the Spratly Islands, that becomes permanent. Now, they've already done that in the past to some extent in some of the areas in the Paracels like Woody Island, so that's not necessarily anything new. But it is very new to come to the Spratly Islands. I do believe that the World Court will rule that those islands do indeed belong to the Philippines, but as you've seen, China has indicated that they are not going to recognize a ruling by the World Court. I think at that time, the United States and its allies there has to act as though those islands are the sovereign territory of the Philippines and make sure that we exert military presence there to show the Chinese that we are going to recognize what we believe is the sovereign claim by the Philippines. And that, in and of itself, does ratchet up tensions there. My concern is that if there's a mistake or miscalculation made by a naval officer or a Chinese pilot, that could accelerate into something unforeseen in a situation where it arises into conflict.
We will be watching this very closely, as will you, Congressman. You've called for a new strategy for dealing with these challenges. It certainly seems as though it's in order, as is the rebuilding of our military post-haste. As Don Rumsfeld famously said, you go to war with the Army, or in this case, perhaps the Navy, you have, and as you've been trying to point out at the Readiness Subcommittee on the Armed Services Committee more generally, and of course in the sea power context and shipbuilding contexts, we've got to get about the business of restoring our Navy to the first order. Thank you very much for your time, sir, for your service to our country. I hope you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Gordon Chang joins us next. We'll talk more about this China threat and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's one of the high points of our week is our chance to visit with one of the country's preeminent authorities on Asia, a portfolio that happens to be very busy at the moment. He is, of course, Gordon Chang, a contributor to The Daily Beast, a columnist at Forbes.com, and a blogger at WorldAffairsJournal.com, and you frequently see his handsome face at Fox News and elsewhere. He is currently in Singapore on assignment. We catch up with him there, forward deployed, as they say. Gordon, as always, it's good to chat with you. Thanks so much for finding the time.
And thanks so much, Frank.
There are big developments underway as we speak in a place called the Scarborough Shoal. Where on earth is that, Gordon Chang, and why is it important?
Yeah, Scarborough Shoal is about 120 miles from Luzon, very close to the opening to Manila Bay. It can control the most important sea lanes around the Philippines. And right now, the Chinese have increased their presence of their ships around the shoal, which they seized from the Philippines in early 2012. There are indications that they've got survey ships in the area, which means that they probably will start reclamation. If they do, it means that they are going to grab hold and keep something that they took through an act of aggression. This would be a red line, and I think that this would plunge the region into chaos because it would teach the Chinese that aggression pays. We cannot let them learn that lesson.
If indeed they have not already learned it in the Spratlys and the Paracels. But Gordon, you've indicated that there has been some pushback by the United States military on the Chinese, in particular in the Scarborough Shoal area. Discuss what that has involved to date and what might be our next step.
Yeah, we've flown jets and helicopters close to Scarborough to tell the Chinese that we can establish a presence over the feature in case there is a confrontation. I suspect we're going to see more of our Navy in the area to tell the Chinese that they can't start reclamation. You know, Frank, 50 years from now, we could look back at Scarborough Shoal as being as important as the Sudetenland. You know, I hope that it's something that we all can forget. But this can be the place where the United States and China take a confrontation and actually go to war. It is that serious. This is a place where the Chinese have indicated they are going to go forward because they're about to lose a UN arbitration in The Hague. They're going to do something to try to change facts on the ground. Most people think it's going to be Scarborough. And as I said, this is where we have to draw the red line. We have allowed the Chinese much too much latitude in the region, and it's made them realize that they can go forward and destabilize not only the United States and not only are the neighbors, but destabilize the whole basis of the international community's global commons. So that's why this is critical.
Your reference to the Sudetenland, of course, Gordon, was a different kind of scenario, one in which the West simply chose to avert its gaze as an act of aggression was accomplished at the time by Adolf Hitler in a part of Germany he wasn't supposed to be militarizing. If that is, in fact, the parallel here, it may not preclude war. It may just postpone it to a moment when it's going to be waged on even less favorable terms to the United States and its allies than would be the case today. Is that the parallel you're drawing as well?
Yes, well, I certainly think when you look back at history, the Western allies didn't go to war over Sudetenland. As you say, they just agreed to turn it over to the Third Reich. And then, you know, Hitler said, well, why don't I invade Poland? Now, I know that the British and French said they're going to go to war, but they didn't go to war over my remilitarization of the Rhineland. They didn't go to war when we took over Austria. They didn't go to war over Sudetenland. So why are they going to go to war over Poland? Well, guess what? Britain and France found themselves backed into a corner, and they had to go to war over Poland. And Hitler must have been more surprised than anybody on earth that Paris and London showed some backbone. But they did it too late, and the cost that we know is 75 million lives in World War II. So that's what we're talking about now, except that today our weapons are so much more destructive than they were at the end of the 1930s. And I actually don't think that a conflict with China is going to stay conventional. So that's why it's very important that we deter them from doing things that will destabilize the international community, which means we've got to do that now because we didn't do it in the last administration. We haven't done it now in this administration. And, you know, God knows, we just don't have very much room left to ensure peace in the region.
Yeah. When you say our weapons, of course, Gordon, I know you mean our weapons and our potential enemies' weapons are much, much more devastating than was true even of those of World War II. One of the other pieces of this, which we've talked about a lot, Gordon, but you've written about recently in Forbes, is the political turmoil that is now much in evidence in Beijing is quite possibly contributing to not only China's economic difficulties, but also to the likelihood of aggressive behavior abroad. Xi Jinping, the president of China, has recently assumed a new title as commander-in-chief. Talk a bit about what you think are the next steps likely from a China afflicted with this kind of uncertainty and instability.
It was a very chilling image when we saw Xi Jinping in battle fatigues when he was announced as commander-in-chief of a joint operations battle group. In other words, taking direct command of the People's Liberation Army, and his predecessors hadn't done that. I think what's going on here is that Xi Jinping is involved in intense infighting with other senior leaders, and what he's trying to do is get the military on his side, which means that very hostile and belligerent flag officers, generals and admirals, are going to be able to set the tone for Chinese foreign policy, as they have increasingly done over the last 3 or 4 years. And so that's why I think when you look at what's going on inside Beijing as these leaders fight, that it's going to have consequences for the region and for the United States.
Indeed, it certainly seems so. Gordon, let me turn to one other piece of your portfolio. Again, our guest is Gordon Chang, the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. And that would be what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. On the one hand, the North Koreans are continuing to act more and more belligerently. There's talk that after a recent missile test failure, they may do a fifth nuclear test. At the same time, the South Koreans are becoming increasingly frantic, I think is the right word for it, to obtain a more advanced anti-missile system from the United States, the so-called THAAD system, which the Chinese are dead set against. Read us in on what's going on there, Gordon.
Yeah, there are a couple things going on. On Saturday, the North Koreans tested a submarine-launched missile. It was a partial success. It certainly made a lot of progress over the test at the end of last year. The missile broke the water, ignited, and traveled 30 kilometers. Didn't travel as far as the North Koreans wanted, but they've shown that they've mastered the important technologies. And so they're making really fast progress. At the same time, the South Koreans want to defend themselves with the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD. They're trying to get China's consent to it, but I don't think Beijing is going to give it. And so we're coming to a showdown with the United States and the South Koreans on one side and China and the North Koreans on the other. That's the way the region is shaping up in North Asia. And by the way, we've got this problem in North Korea at the same time we've got problems in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea. So all along China's periphery, we have confrontations.
And this is a rich grist for your mill, needless to say, Gordon Chang at Forbes and Fox and the Daily Beast, and also for ours. We appreciate you shedding light on it. Safe travels, my friend, in the Western Pacific, and come back to us again safe and sound and very soon. Next up, Stella Morabito, one of our country's most profound thinkers about culture wars and groupthink, joins us to talk about what's happening on our campuses and what it might mean for you. More straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over the weekend, President Obama implicitly declared himself the arbiter of the arc of history. He asserted that his host, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, is on the right side of it. That only shows how much on the wrong side he is. In just the past week, Mr. Obama declared himself in favor of Eurostatism and Britain's continued submission to it. His administration signed a climate change accord that will wreck the U.S. energy industry without appreciable impact on whatever warming is happening. He is sending more forces to Syria without a coherent strategy, and even as he hollows out the U.S. military. And he supports open borders for Islamic supremacist migration. Ronald Reagan's view of history was one that he would shape with a basic goal. We win, they lose. Barack Obama seems to prefer they win, we lose. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have with us Stella Morabito. She is an extraordinary contributor to our understanding of some of the aspects of our crisis of civilizations, I guess I would call it, that is informed, I think, by her work as an intelligence analyst in the past, focusing on Soviet and Russian politics, including how the communists used media to propagandize, indoctrinate, and dominate populations. A very handy expertise when dealing with the groupthink of today. Stella is a contributor, a senior contributor, in fact, at The Federalist, a superb online resource where she blogs on society, culture, education, and more. You can also find her writings at stellamorabito.net. Stella, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Frank.
You know, Stella, these are syndromes that you're very familiar with and have been warning of for some time. Talk a little bit, if you would, about this as not just a sort of an abstraction, but as a very practical problem that we're facing, particularly in academia. I'm thinking especially of the reporting that you've been doing about what's been going on at Stanford University over the question of whether to teach Western civilization there any longer.
Yes, that was a really fascinating development at Stanford. When you had about over 350 students who actually petitioned to get on the ballot for undergraduate elections, a question as to whether or not to revive the study of Western civilization. And just that in itself, I think, was a ray of light, of hope. And the fact that that question was defeated, I think we all kind of expected that. Because it was really set up as a requirement. And what I find most interesting is that about 17% actually voted for that. And, you know, after so many years, generations, in fact, of the cultivation of ignorance and political correctness and groupthink, I actually think that is a hopeful sign.
That even 17% might still think this is an important topic for them to be trained in. And you've talked about the tools that are being used, and I mentioned your background with sort of communists' use of such tools of coercion and thought policing and surveillance by peers. Is that really what's going on at places like Stanford and other universities these days?
Well, I honestly think it's really a, you know, kind of a human phenomenon, and yes, and especially in academia, because that is where the presumably the leaders of tomorrow come from. And what's happened through education reforms, not just in, you know, academia, but, you know, K-12 education over the years. I even remember it in high school, the fragmentation of knowledge and what I call the cultivation of ignorance, has kind of reached kind of a tipping point now. And what's involved in it, I would say, there are different, if I call it a three-pronged attack, but the attack on independent thought. I mean, this is really a war against allowing, you know, human beings to really express what they believe freely. And how to go about that in a free society? Well, I think first, if you were a totalitarian trying to, wage war against independent thought in order to centralize power, first you would cultivate ignorance. You'd have to cultivate a lot of ignorance in a society like this. And so you go about it by promoting courses on the, with some other, not for the sake of, bringing about knowledge, but you would call it something along the lines of increasing the relevance of classes or diversity or whatever else. Western civilization is particularly a target because not only are we talking about history, literature, the arts, and all of these forms, which, by the way, have their source in the Middle East, Mesopotamia, the Sumerian culture, and all of that, while white-skinned peoples were running around Europe. That's another irony that, those who claim it's all ethnocentric. But anyway, I'm diverting a little. But another way of going about it, in addition to cultivating ignorance, is of that history, is you remove the tools of independent thought, which Western civilization has brought us, things like the Socratic method, rules of order, civil discourse, things like debating societies, where people are free to express what they believe and then, try to arrive at some kind of consensus of what reality is or what truth is. By going to war against Western Civ, you basically abolish those tools of learning. So once you've cultivated ignorance, another piece of it is to polarize, and that's done through the identity politics and this whole grievance industry.
And through the application of techniques like Saul Alinsky's to heighten that kind of polarization and
absolutely.
And freezing.
And Frank, you know this directly through, the Southern Poverty Law Center is just basically, it's like nothing more. When you think about it, you can crystallize it into just kind of like playground cooties kind of games where they pick and choose, who's in, who's out, and then try to create this polarization, separation, of people so that they won't freely associate with one another and exchange ideas.
Right, for the purposes of domination and using these identity techniques to maintain effectively control. And you've warned particularly, Stella Morabito, about how all this is likely, if it's not properly understood, to foster in millennials and younger Americans of an affinity for socialism that history would suggest is very misplaced. Talk about that for a moment, if you would.
Well, I think is it really an affinity for socialism? To a certain extent, yes. I mean, people talk about, you know, college students paying up to their ears in debt and what have they got to show for it and the economy. So they are easy targets for selling the idea of socialism, especially since they've never really been equipped to think independently about these things and don't really have the foundational knowledge to compare systems.
But in addition, there are these blandishments of social justice and, you know, trying to prevent the 1% from enjoying all of the profits and so on.
And here's where I kind of diverge, is that I think there is something else going on under the surface with these students who have been really, you know, had their tools of learning stolen from them. That, you know, they're not really equipped to think things through. It really is a grand theft kind of operation that's been going on. But what else is going on is because they have this loss, it comes out in other ways by they're very, this whole thing is conducive to getting students to adopt personas. And social justice warrior is basically, I think, I look at it as a persona that a lot of students have adopted so that they'll fit in. It's this whole social engineering thing that is really at the basis of it. I don't know that they really believe this stuff. I don't know that they really even understand this stuff. I think it's a persona that they wear because they've had so much knowledge stolen from them.
It's what's left, in a matter of speaking. Stella Morbito, this is such a profoundly worrying problem, and I appreciate so much your addressing it forthrightly and with great clarity and courage at The Federalist and also, of course, at stellamorabito.net. I hope you'll come back to us often because I think that understanding sort of some of these cultural dynamics and the use being made of them by, well, frankly, our enemies is incredibly important to understanding the challenges of our time. Keep up that good work and do come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk to Patrick Dunleavy about jihad in jail and whether it's coming to you straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have joining us once again Patrick Dunleavy, a man with an extensive and very impressive career in law enforcement in New York State, starting as a corrections officer, working his way up to be the Deputy Inspector General of the Criminal Intelligence Unit. He's a man who I've turned to from time to time for his insights on a very important problem, and that is what is going on inside prison systems, including ours, involving the inculcation of jihadism among those imprisoned. It's a privilege to have him back with us. And Patrick Dunleavy, thank you very much for your work, both past and present, to bring our attention to these very, very vexing problems. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with insights that you've taken from what we've learned about recent jihadist attacks in Europe as it relates to their correctional system and penetration thereof by the jihadis.
Yeah, the most recent being the attack in Brussels on both the airport and the metro line, and the individuals there, two of the brothers, Ibrahim and Khalid al-Baraki were former inmates in the Belgian prison system. They were minor criminals. One was in for a robbery, another was in for a carjacking. We know that certain individuals that were in Brussels who recently captured Saleh Abdeslam wanted in connection with the November Paris attacks that killed over 130 people, that his brother and he had also been former inmates in the French prison system. We go back to the Charlie Hebdo attack. Two of the individuals there, Sharif and Saeed Kouachi, they were brothers. And also Ahmed Kolavi had been former inmates in the French prison system. Mohamed Marat, 2012, in Toulouse, France, who opened fire, killing three French military men, three children, and a rabbi, had spent a couple of years in the French prison system. The UK has had extensive problems with their prison system and radicalized inmates spreading the message of jihad, even to the point of taking over whole cell blocks and extorting inmates to either pay protection or to submit to Sharia law. In fact, one of the inmates, Michael Abdebalo, who had been incarcerated for the killing of a British soldier, Lee Rigby, was one of the proselytizers who was radicalizing other inmates. So they had to separate him and move him to another prison.
Speaking of Britain, Patrick Dunleavy, we've had a report, which you've called attention to at your blog, about essentially the British authorities losing control of one or more of their prisons, even a maximum security prison. What on earth is going on there? And to the extent that it is going on there, is it something that suggests that this problem is going to be vastly larger for the society writ large, not just the prison system?
Again, the thing that has happened in the UK going all the way back to Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, who was a low-level criminal in the UK prison system, was converted to Islam, came out, and then attended the Finsbury Mosque in the UK.
So there was one of the most radical in the country.
Exactly. So we saw that there was a funneling at that point from inmates who had converted to a certain form of Islam within the UK prison system, then going to selected mosques that also held to the radical ideology. We see that even now. There was a recent article with respect to literature in the UK prison system that had been placed by prison imams. That was somewhat of a Wahhabi Salafist theology, again, being placed in the prison cells in the prison common areas where inmates would pick them up, sort of like what we would say a gospel tract somewhere. Only this particular literature was, again, calling for that radical form of Islam.
And the jihad to impose it worldwide. Patrick Dunleavy, during your time in the New York State criminal justice system, you participated in a very important investigation called Operation Hades, which looked at the extent to which there is a similar sort of prison recruitment operation going on here in the United States by jihadist imams. To the extent that you can, talk about this not only in an historical context, but in today's time as well. Give us a flavor of the magnitude of that problem in our own country.
Well, the first thing we saw was the fact that the most prison officials, administrators, were not really cognizant of the differences in Islam itself. They primarily saw it as a form of religion that would be good for inmates in helping with rehabilitation. They were not aware that at the time, going back as late as the 1970s, where the Saudis began to send literature through groups like the Graduate Institute of Islamic Studies and the Islamic Society of North America into the prison, which, again, preached that Salafist Wahhabi form of Islam. It was a fundamentalist movement to establish in each prison. We also found that we had in the prison system a certain group of inmates from what I would call countries of interest, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, the West Bank and Jordan and stuff like that. And we found that they had an influence on the Muslim inmates who were primarily African-American inmates with following the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad.
You know, there's one other piece of this that I've been very troubled by, and that is you mentioned the Saudis and their books, their funding. There was also a decision made, as you know, I'm sure, Patrick, by the Clinton administration to empower one Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi to become the authority for recruiting, training, and credentialing chaplains for the U.S. prison system, also for the U.S. military, by the way. And it appears that even though he was subsequently convicted of terrorism charges and is now in supermax prison himself, the imams he brought into the prison system to promote, as you say, the Saudis, I guess, could call it whatever they want to, but it seems to be the authoritative version of Islam, Sharia, and to promote it for the purposes of bringing people to jihad. This is a time bomb, it would seem to me, in our prison systems and, again, for our society writ large, especially, Patrick, if we wind up having, in the name of criminal justice reform, lots of these guys turned loose. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's exactly correct. And one of the things with hiring Islamic clergy in the beginning for the prison system is, again, what was unknown to prison officials, they defer to certain individuals who were suspect, the individual that you mentioned, as well as another individual by the name of Warisdeen Umar. And what the Saudis did is, as the clergy were hired in the United States, they then also provided funding so that those clergy, newly hired Islamic clergy, could be sent to Saudi Arabia to complete the Hajj, one of the five tenets in Islam. So there was not only the literature to be given to the inmates, but there was the training to be given to the clergy.
Yeah, very, very dubious combination, needless to say. Patrick Dunleavy, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we'll talk more about what it means in practice to have these criminal justice institutions as petri dishes for jihad. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Patrick Dunleavy, one of the country's preeminent authorities on criminal justice, and in particular on the issues associated with the jihadists who have gotten inside the system, inside our prisons. He is the author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. He has formerly served as a deputy inspector general, including with responsibility of the organization's criminal intelligence unit. He is a go-to guy on this very, very important subject. And Patrick, we've been talking about the extent to which the prison administrators and wardens weren't quite clued up about what they were dealing with in terms of the imams who were trained in Saudi Arabia and who were equipped with Saudi indoctrination materials for their prisoners. I remember back in 2004, a very important hearing that Senator John Kyle, chairman of the Terrorism Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, held. And when he asked these administrators and wardens about what was going on, they enthused about these imams. And one of the things that they said, which has stuck with me to this day, was that they were particularly appreciative that they were turning some of the most dangerous prisoners in the system into model prisoners. And that presumably conduced to them becoming parolees and therefore set loose on the society at large. With your background, talk a bit about that phenomenon, that willful blindness perhaps, and what it means for our society if these guys do get out.
Absolutely. One of the things that is common is that prison administrators are faced with the task of preventing escapes, preventing assault on staff, and a rehabilitative process of convicted felons. So simply what happens when an individual becomes, quote, what we'll call jail-wise, he's now a polite inmate. He's now someone who's not going to argue with the officers. He's not going to try to assault or deal drugs or escape. So when jihadists in prison figure that out, and they see, as a good friend of mine, John Cutter, former deputy chief of NYPD intelligence, once said, they realize their goal is beyond the wall. And so they adapt their behavior while incarcerated to be a model inmate. The interesting thing about that is one of the individuals we were talking about in Brussels, responsible for the November Paris attacks, Saleh Abdeslam, was captured right before the Belgian Brussels attacks, and now is in a maximum security prison in Belgium. Well, he has been described right now as a, quote, very good boy. He is a model prisoner. There has not been one negative word about his actions while he has been incarcerated. Well, that's the description of the prisons of that inmate, who we know is responsible for attacks in Paris that were resulting in the death of over 130 30 individuals. One other, we think that that's only happening in Europe. I'm going to read from a court decision by a federal judge in Indiana who was holding a hearing regarding a convicted terrorist, John Walker Lynn, otherwise known as the American Taliban, who had been in prison. He filed a lawsuit so that he could be out of his cell whenever he wanted. The Bureau of Prisons attempted to stop that action. This is what the judge said about John Walker Lynn. Said John Walker Lynn is a well-known as the American Taliban. He pleaded guilty to supplying services to the Taliban and carrying an improvised explosive device during the commission of a felony. However, his prison record paints a different portrait. His scant nonviolent disciplinary history during his incarceration has merited him a classification of low security. This has duped even the judges to say, well, you may have been a terrorist, but you're a model inmate.
Patrick Dunleavy, let me just ask you about one other example of being duped. We have, in several different connections, the argument being made that jihadists, among other prisoners, but specifically jihadists, can be released and there is not going to be a problem with recidivism. This is particularly evident in connection with what President Obama has been doing to dismantle the Guantanamo Bay facility and move its detainees elsewhere. To some extent, it's also at work in this criminal justice reform business. Give us a flavor, as a professional corrections officer and administrator, of how this really works in practice. Are these guys going to remain on the right side of the law, be model citizens once out?
Well, the recidivism rate for a common criminal ranges anywhere from 40% to 67% based on Department of Justice statistics. So what prison officials do is they have programs designed to help individuals reacclimate themselves into society. If they have educational needs, or if they need for programs for alternatives to violence, we have all these rehabilitative programs while the inmate is incarcerated and then post-release. However, for terrorists, particularly jihadists, there is no program. There is no de-radicalization or rehabilitation program for that type of criminal. Subsequently, when they get out, and there's no monitoring, by the way. We have a monitoring system for sex offenders who are released. There's a registration for them, so we know where they live and what they do. But there is nothing for the convicted terrorist who now gets out of prison. So we're going to have a recidivism rate there, even if it's at the low end of 30%. Within the next 5 years, 100 inmates in prison for terror crimes will be released. If only 30 of them go back to the battlefield, that is a danger we cannot accept.
Well, and it isn't just going to be a some distant battlefield, I'm afraid. It will almost certainly be, in some cases at least, societies, as we saw in Paris and in Brussels and perhaps
where they live.
Here
that's exactly
well.
What ISIS is calling for, individuals to commit the jihad where they live.
Let me just ask you, because I was struck by something you quoted the other day, a statement by John Carlin, the Justice Department's Assistant Attorney General for National Security. Would you just reprise that quote for us?
Yeah, what John said, and he was asked with respect to these at least 100 inmates who will be released when in the not-too-distant future, he said, what happens when these folks start getting out? There are programs for drug addicts and gang members. There is not one with a proven track record for terrorists. Not one program with a proven track record.
So what you're saying, Patrick, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think these are the words basically you've just described, is that even the Obama administration's senior official with responsible for national security matters at the Justice Department acknowledges that what we're likely to have when, through one device or another, the president's a transfer of these detainees from Gitmo or his paroling or commutation of sentences of so-called nonviolent drug offenders, unquote, is going to be the insinuation into our society of people there is no chance are going to remain on the right side of the law. They will be obliged by their Sharia doctrine to engage in jihad, and we've done nothing really to prevent that from happening. Is that a fair characterization of your view?
Yeah, and neither is there a monitoring system. As I said, sex offenders have to register, and they have to law enforcement is notified as to where they live and where they can't live. The interesting thing is we've known about terrorists in prison for going back to pre-9/11. And we know that eventually they're going to get out, yet we've developed no program, no effective proven program that either deals with de-radicalization or monitoring of those individuals.
This is insane and malfeasant, it seems to me. Patrick Dunleavy, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a subject we will return to, though, and I hope we'll be able to continue to draw on your expertise, specifically that in your superb book on this very subject, The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. Check it out, folks, and also Patrick Dunleavy's blog at blogspot.com. Keep up the good work, sir. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.